The first round of the 2025 NBA playoffs have officially come to a close, and four teams in both the Eastern and Western Conference, respectively, will now get a chance to face off against one another in the conference semifinal round. Shortly following a pair of win-or-go-home Game 7, we had the chance to witness unfold this past weekend. What's going on, world, and welcome to the new 24. The Cal Corver episode, as we've officially reached 26 episodes for those keeping score, wherever you may be listening in from across the globe, as we thank you for taking some time to hear us share what we think on everything that has transpired throughout the postseason thus far. I'm your host, Gabriel Wilkins, and as always, I'm joined beside my co-host and Torrin Stagger, yet again to provide you with the breakdown on it all around the association. What's going on, man?
Doing great, man. How's everybody doing out there? Episode 26. Let's do it.
On the previous episode of the new 24, me and Torrance took some time to break down just how important Michael Porter Jr. is in his role as the Denver Nuggets' primary X factor just a few days prior to them knocking off the LA Clippers in an epic seven-game series during round one to march into the West semis for the third consecutive season, while also evaluating the playoff debut of Detroit Pistons all-star guard Cade Cunningham, who recently became one of only three players to average 25-plus points and 8-plus rebounds and assists through his first five postseason games prior to his spectacular 2024-25 season, coming to a close in six games against the New York Knicks over in the East. Now, we'll take a moment to break down the things that fans listening in should have their eyes on as it pertains to round two, as the conference semifinal round is officially underway, where there appears to be no such thing as home court advantage. But before we get into the four series on the docket, let's take a moment to show some love to the NBA's finest performers who recently received hardware for their spectacular work during the regular season as part of this week's opening tip-off segment, starting with a young guard who, after taking home a national championship at UConn in his lone year on campus last year, has added yet another esteemed accolade to his resume following his first year in the NBA by the name of Stephon Castle. The fourth overall pick in the 2024 NBA draft was named Rookie of the Year last week, joining his teammate Victor Wembanyama as the second consecutive San Antonio Spurs player to win the award. The 20-year-old won the award in overwhelming fashion over Zachary Richardson of the Atlanta Hawks and Jalen Wells of the Memphis Grizzlies to become the fourth Spur in the history of the franchise to take home the Wilt Chamberlain Trophy alongside Hall of Famers and David Robinson and Tim Duncan, not to mention another guard who became the first player since Alvin Robertson during the 1990-91 season to average 3 steals per game, on the way to recording the most total steals ever in a season since Gary Payton over 29 years ago and Dyson Daniels of the Atlanta Hawks, as the man known by many as the Great Barrier Thief became the first Australian-born player to capture Most Improved Player honors, as the former NBA G League Ignite star took home the award over finalist Ivica Zubac of the Los Angeles Clippers and Cade Cunningham. And last but not least, one of the game's premier tacticians who guided the Cleveland Cavaliers to the best record in the Eastern Conference during his first year on the job, and Kenny Atkinson, is the former assistant to Steve Kerr out in Golden State, received 59 out of a possible 100 first-place votes from the media panel to garner this year's NBA Coach of the Year Award over Detroit Pistons head coach J.B. Bickerstaff and Houston Rockets head coach Ime Udoka to become the first Cav head coach since Mike Brown all the way back in 2009 to win it. We also want to give some kudos to the Oklahoma City Thunder and their executive vice president and general manager Sam Presti for winning the Executive of the Year Award as well, marking the first time that Presti has earned the annual honor after building a team that managed to finish the regular season with the best record in the NBA, not to mention giving a full-fledged salute to the NBA's all-time winningest head coach and five-time champion, Greg Popovich, who decided to make his transition from the coaching ranks to focus on his role as president in the front office for the San Antonio Spurs this past weekend, after roaming across the sidelines as the head coach of the iconic franchise over the past 29 seasons down in Alamo, where Mitch Johnson is set to officially take over the reins as the successor to the Hall of Famer starting next season. Torrance, as I said earlier, in addition to this, we also had a pleasure of seeing a pair of Game 7s, both of which took place on the Western Conference side of things, as the Nuggets would manage to take advantage of their home crowd in Denver to knock off the Clippers, while the Warriors, after dropping Games 5 and 6 in their opening round series against the Rockets, would prove to have just enough to knock off Houston on the road to advance to punch their ticket into the conference semis once again. When you look back over the week that was, what are some of the top storylines that stood out to you pertaining to teams we either saw either get eliminated or advance onward into the next round since we last got behind the microphone?
Well, at the top of the top, I'm going to start with the Milwaukee Bucks. The last few years, I mean, every year since they've won the championship in 2021, every postseason has been injury after injury after injury. First round exit, first round exit. And I think it's clear to see that it's time for a change. Now, with the way the salary structure is in the league right now, and with the players and assets they have, the best way to start over is to trade Giannis, logically speaking. And we got rumors out here of New York, Brooklyn, the two LA teams. Some people trying to force and push the Chicago Bulls narrative. Others can see the possibilities of a Golden State or a Houston. I mean, it's Giannis. Who wouldn't want him? He's one of the greatest basketball players of all time, at least an achievement, if you don't like his game so much on the court, but it's highly effective. We know the Damian Lillard, and we know that Dame preference was the Miami Heat, but ending up with Giannis was supposed to be a great consolation prize. Really hasn't been a beautiful story. And last but not least over there, my main man, Doc Rivers. Mo check, more first round exit. I mean, I'm even wondering at some point if the Bucks are looking to rebuild, how will Doc get himself out of that situation?
When I look at the Bucks situation, they got the sixth highest payroll in the NBA this season. Damian Lillard, prior to him tearing his Achilles, was a guy that was looked at as a potential trade target for certain contenders in the event that the Bucks happened to get dispatched in the first round, which they did at the hands of the Indiana Pacers. I have Damian Lillard's contract numbers in front of him. He's set to be owed $58.5 million going into next season, which is basically going to be a year in which he's seeking to recover and rehab from his injury. And I highly doubt or expect him to play in any NBA act going into 25-26. And then he has a $63.2 million player option for the 26-27 season, which I'm pretty sure he's going to pick up. But I don't know how you move him now with him being hurt and him being at the age in which he currently is at 34, soon to be 35 this upcoming July. Giannis, like you said, Torrance, is your best trade asset. There's a possibility if you trade him, you're going to have to seek to get whatever you can, not only just for Giannis, but for other pieces such as Bobby Portis, should he pick up his $13.4 million player option, and seek to do whatever you can to shop around Kyle Kuzma as well and get yourself ready for what would be a rebuild if you do decide to trade the best player arguably in the history of your franchise outside of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
And the Los Angeles Lakers, another first-round exit, another new coach, another summer pretending to wonder about what LeBron James will do. You got Luka Doncic in the fold now. We know that Luka got to make some improvements in conditioning and on the defensive end, but the Lakers have a roster problem. You got a perennial all-star in Luka. You have an aging superstar in LeBron James. And then you're surrounded by a bunch of low spades, I should call it, if anybody out there familiar with the game of spades. Is Austin Reeves really a starter on all 30 teams in the NBA? Probably not. Rui Hachimura, Dorian Finney-Smith, Jackson Hayes, Dalton Knecht, Gabe Vincent. When you look at teams like the Minnesota Timberwolves, they got guys on their bench who could start for a lot of teams. Pay them top dollar to start. Boston, OKC. If they don't have great bench players, they have strong starting five. The Lakers haven't had a strong starting five since they won the championship in the bubble in the first half of the next season. So, yeah, you can blame LeBron and his salary. You could blame Luka and his conditioning. You can blame JJ for playing his starters too long. But like I said during the last game, him not playing Jackson Hayes is a message to Rob Pelinka. You sent us in here to complete a mission without proper resources. You rescinded the trade for Mark Williams. You didn't pick up anybody at the center position. You knew that that's Luka's backup plan when he drives to the rim and can't get a shot off because he doesn't have any lift. Well, I can throw this lob up behind the defense. You didn't provide him that option. You didn't provide him and LeBron and Austin Reeves who are your perimeter defenders. You didn't provide them any level of rim protection. I always say, man, Rob Pelinka, Kobe best friend. Kobe got five and Magic got five. Maybe it's the LeBron fan in me, but I know sabotage when I see it. Yeah. Oh, well, we drafted his son. You do these little favors to make people feel like, you know, what a lot of you choose to believe, but the real job being done right now. It's just a matter of when will Rob Pelinka actually step down and really do his real job is to build a championship team. Getting Luka's not the job. You still got to surround Luka with what he needs. JJ Redick, I would say he's shown a great interest in developing guys. We saw Max Christie's development over the season and you traded him away. I'll be honest with you. I probably would have kept Max Christie over Austin Reeves because Max Christie can hit an open three and he can guard on the perimeter. Figure it out, man.
No, I'm with you on that one. A lot of people don't grasp that context and understanding when it comes to looking at these rosters. And they so quick to assess the performance of J.J. Redick, who dealt with a lot in his first year as a head coach with the Los Angeles Lakers. And I'm not just talking about losing his house in a wildfire. I'm talking about dealing with constant turnover on the roster, but maximizing the most out of the resources which he had. You talk about Max Christie. Max Christie was a guy that Lakers fans called for getting playing time his first couple of years in the league under Darvin Ham, who didn't play the young fella enough. J.J. Redick in his first season emphasizes full-on confidence in Max Christie, moves him into the starting lineup when guys are hurt. You see him flourishing, playing solid basketball, and then he gets dealt as a part of the Luka Doncic trade. And understandably, you get a guy that's 25 years old, coming in the door, hasn't even touched the prime of his career, you could make the case or argument for. However, you traded away not only Max Christie, but your best defensive big in Anthony Davis. And yeah, that Mark Williams trade, I really thought that that was a game-changing move after getting Luka Doncic. And that was a move that we expected the Lakers to make after getting Luka Doncic, was to get a five. And once that trade got rescinded to not address that position, it proved to be their doom. I know we both went with the Lakers to beat Minnesota, and a lot of that was due to who was on the floor, number 23. You know, it's hard to go against that guy, right? But at the same time, when you have a team that has size like the Minnesota Timberwolves, combined with depth, it's a tough ask and it's a tall task to try and overcome, which, as we know, they fell short. But I want to open up things on my side, shouting out the Detroit Pistons for putting together a hell of a season. I know Torrance throughout the year was adamant about how they finally got a head coach that wanted to be in the building and J.B. Bickerstaff, who helped to give the franchise a sense of stability after years of struggling, and discussed alongside myself how the young talent was already there in place. However, to go from owning the worst record in the league at 14-68 just a season ago to 44-38 and earning a spot in the playoffs is no small feat over the course of a year's time, especially when you consider the fact that they improved their win total by 30 games, becoming the first team in league history to more than triple their win total after posting a franchise worst record mark during the 23-24 campaign. You know about the emergence of Cade Cunningham, Ausar Thompson, not to mention Jalen Duren, who came onto the scene as one of the best young centers in the game, something you've heard me state repeatedly over the last 10 weeks here on the new 24. And I know they lost in six at the hands of the New York Knicks in their opening round series, but when you put all of that into context, what they were able to accomplish without the services of Jaden Ivey in the backcourt, all the way dating to January due to suffering a broken left fibula. Not to mention being without Isaiah Stewart due to inflammation flaring up in his right knee after game one of that series, who came along as a key reserve for them this season, providing toughness on the interior. I don't think that they have too much to hang their head down about. Is now comes the time where you can go about getting right to put in the work over the course of the summer in search of a better ending the next go-round. I don't think I'd be alone in saying that they seem to be on the right track after what we saw in the postseason from them. I'm very curious, just as those around the 313 are, just to see what moves they seek to make over the offseason once that time comes to supply Cade Cunningham and company with additional firepower that they can go to that can help take the pressure off of number two when teams seek to double up on him, which he saw a lot of in the postseason. And I'm sure he'll find a way to get adjusted to it in the future.
The thing with Detroit in the position that they're in, bringing in Malik Beasley, Tim Hardaway Jr., Tobias Harris. You brought in some good veterans who are pretty much career role players for the most part. Those guys, they've stuck in the league this long because they know how to stick to those roles, bring no complications to the team. Now, a lot of teams in this position normally mess up because they end up packaging up some of their young promising players and future picks to go get an over-the-hill all-star, an aging veteran, somebody with a name whose game doesn't quite match where they are at that point in their career because you had a little bit of success and now you're starting to see the light. You got to slow down on the road when that light gets bright. Allow Cade to develop. Allow Ivy to come back, get healthy, continue to develop. Jalen Duran as well. Ron Holland. And maybe, you know, your first round draft pick this summer. Maybe you go pick up another veteran along the lines of the three guys I mentioned previously. You don't always got to try to shoot right to the top. Boston's still there. Cleveland's still there. You got to be honest and realistic about the steps that it's going to take. Sometimes you got to wait for guys to age out of a spot before you can take it. Don't mess it up too fast because I look at a team like the Memphis Grizzlies going to go get a guy like Marcus Smart. That trade could have been for a scoring wing, but you live and you learn.
Yeah, and I want to take a moment to assess the season of the Houston Rockets as well. Just a couple of years ago, you know, Houston finished 22-60 on the year. They fired Steven Silas and brought in Ime Udoka, who we know ever since his arrival has done nothing but help Clutch City get back on track as they finished 41-41 a season ago and followed that up with a 52-win campaign this year, which was good enough to get the 2 seed in the West. We saw the flashes of greatness from Alperen Sengun in the playoffs in spite of a Game 7 performance that was rough for him on a night where you could say he bailed Draymond Green out with the fadeaways and turnaround shots he settled for as opposed to trying to go through his chest and be physical up against the Defensive Player of the Year candidate. I know Jalen Green struggled immensely throughout the series against Golden State as well, as we didn't get the performance we wanted to see from him outside of his 38-point night in Game 2. But keep in mind that this is a young team that you got a chance to see and that it sometimes requires tough experiences in order to learn how to win down the road this time of year, especially for a team that made their first playoff appearance beside one another. And with the exception of vets such as Fred VanVleet, Dylan Brooks, Steven Adams, and Jeff Green, they never saw the playoffs within their careers until now. So Rafael Stone has some tough decisions to make, the GM of the Rockets, in the coming days, starting with whether or not he's going to decide to pick up the team option that they have on Fred VanVleet next year, that if they elect to, will grant him $45 million, as reports out of H-Town following Game 7 indicate that the team will likely do so, not to mention which given pieces will be put up on the block in an effort to obtain that superstar piece that they could pair beside Sengun and Amen Thompson to possibly get past round one and make that appearance in the conference semis this time next year, and their quest to get another step closer to a championship. We know the defense is legit, but that offense, as those unfamiliar with this team prior to the playoffs got a chance to see, is most certainly a work in progress, and they got to seek to get it better in a quest to try and maximize their window to compete in a Western Conference that's not going to wait up.
I keep going back and forth on the whole idea of trading Jalen Green. Today, as of this recording, I'm going to stand on the side of I'm not trading. I still got to give him a chance. Athletically, like I said, besides Anthony Edwards, might not be a more athletic guard in the entire conference, let alone the league. And you have Thompson there. I mean, you have a chance to have two of the most athletic wings in the entire league. He has to get better at shot selection. He has to develop a more authentic feel for the game too, possibly. But the talent is obviously there. I think the Rockets got to like exercise some level of patience. If you're talking about trading for a guy like Kevin Durant, I got to at least see Jalen Green with Kevin Durant for a season or two, watching how KD works and the insights he could possibly provide him. If you go get a Giannis, I still need to see the same thing. Somebody that athletic with Thompson and Giannis on the court. So you got guys like Cam Whitmore, Reed Shepard, Jabari Smith Jr., another guy I'm high on with that team. It's some guys that I probably would trade. Sengun might get traded on my team before Jalen Green. That's just me. You know, he not the most mobile big on the defensive end. I really don't like his shot selection on the offensive end. I don't know. I think that the Houston Rockets are in a similar position to the Detroit Pistons. They just had a bit more regular season success where, you know, you brought in the veterans that pointed out. But it's time to like let those young guys thrive. I think they can do it. I still believe Jalen Green got a few all-star appearances in his future, and hopefully it's with the Houston Rockets.
No, same, man. I think Rafael Stone is going to practice some level of patience. I expect him to make a move or two, but I don't know how big those moves will be. And based on his press conference or end of season exit interview that he did beside Ime Udoka, it seems like they want to practice some level of patience. I don't know if I would be in favor of them getting rid of Sengun. I think Sengun was asked to carry an enormous burden in the midst of this offense that struggled mightily, and they needed him. And even he admitted that he can get better offensively, and he felt like he had a better season offensively the previous year in 23-24 as opposed to 24-25, which ironically was the season in which he earned his first All-Star nod. But a lot of those guys are going to have to get in the lab and commit themselves to being better. And like you say with Jalen Green, he's definitely a guy that has to work on his shot selection and his overall in-game awareness, specifically in key situations.
And last thing on the Rock, Udoka, I believe this was only his third season coaching.
Yeah, this was year two in Houston.
Yeah, and he only got the 1 year in Boston, right? They got to the finals. Yeah. He never got the coach the next season. So this is only his third year in the league. I know they do a lot of praising him in the media and whatnot, and his teams have had great success relative to the teams in the 3 years. He still got a lot of improvement to make as well as a coach. You know what I'm saying? You've been to the playoffs twice, and Steve Kerr kicked your ass out of them twice. And, you know, Steve Kerr, he the big dog now. Pop out of here. So, Steve Kerr, the OG coach in the league right now. It's time for him to make some improvements as well. It was a lot of things I thought he could have done better as a coach throughout that series as well that I'm sure he'll get better with over time. Superstars can't always be the fix.
Absolutely. And as you know, Torrance, we've had questions about Ime Udoka's offense over the last couple of years in which his franchises or squads that he's led have had success in a regular season. And as we saw with the Boston Celtics against the Golden State Warriors, that was a series where I would say the Celtics were the team that was favored by many people. However, due to the championship experience on Golden State's side, you saw them find ways to execute and take advantage and dispatch that Celtics squad 6 games. So I understand where you're coming from. And then I want to get into the team that won 18 out of their last 21 games entering the playoffs, and I thought really had a legit shot of reaching the NBA Finals entering the postseason in the LA Clippers. I know the talk around Tinseltown right now is centered around James Harden's performance in Game 7, if not the missed opportunities to secure the loose rebounds in Games 1 and 4 among those who watched every single minute of what was arguably the best opening round series that we got in the playoffs, as they went up against the Denver Nuggets and fell in defeat. I know that it sucks to see a Kawhi Leonard, who was fully healthy in the postseason for the first time 5 years ago, go out the way that he did as well. But if there's one thing that I hope this series shows the fans across the basketball universe, it's the fact that the changing of the guard is on the horizon. And there's a day where you just have to recognize that the stars you love, even in spite of their nightly greatness from time to time, are also getting older as well. Kudos to Ivica Zubac en route to constructing a career season where the big man averaged a double-double and finished second in the league in field goal percentage during the regular season, behind only Jared Allen of the Cleveland Cavaliers. In addition to Harden, who in spite of not possessing the quick first step we've come to know him for over the years, steered the ship mightily in the Claw's absence early on to not only get another All-Star appearance, but possibly an All-NBA season. However, if you can't truly tell when a player's legs are dead, I really don't know what I could tell you, because I'm not trying to make no excuses for James Harden's performance. There's times where you can say he should have forced the issue some more. He could have sought the drive inside, taking advantage of Denver's lack of perimeter defenders and so forth. I also know what the numbers reflect. But I want to take it away from that, though, and give you a breakdown on the game. You know, the shit that you won't hear on other platforms when you listen to the nonstop instant reactions that lack complete context this time of year. Games like that are why off-ball movement and the development of a low post game is so vital to have in times like these as a go-to in games where you are in a win-or-go-home scenario and you don't always have your legs to get the shots that you want the way that Harden did in Game 6. However, when you're so used to playing five out for the majority of your career, and it's the primary way you've known how to play throughout your days in the league, I guess this is what comes with it. If you watch Kawhi Leonard over the years, you know how much he loves to go to work in a pinch post area of the floor, the way that Kobe Bryant did, the high post area of the floor on the weak side of the court, usually around the elbow for the listeners who may not know. But beside Harden, you'll see that he stands mainly in the corner. And you might wonder why, But when you're playing beside the system, this is the way you oftentimes have to play because there isn't another way. And you live and die with it. And maybe that's why some watching could notice the given frustration that Kawhi might have had when watching him live in action. Sometimes it's a great, you can oftentimes live and die by the sword you have been known to go into battle with. And if you're a fan of Harden, you know what I'm talking about. Or even a stubborn individual that's used to being successful in situations where you may have control of matters at hand. The beard's still an innovative force in the game, but in closeout games, this can bring about a lot of struggles, especially when your legs aren't there to take the step back threes and high altitude. And getting to the rim is a taller task that doesn't merit you a whistle very often this time of year. Clippers got a complex offseason that lies ahead. And if they had any draft picks with young talent to spare, I'm sure they'd be a team in the running for Giannis too. But as you know, they won't go down without a fight. Even if one can question just how much Harden and Leonard have left to shoulder the load of being the primary playmaker, if not top options on the squad at this stage in their career as they approach their mid-30s. But all in all, I'd say they had a nice inaugural year to open up the Intuit Dome, and I'm sure owner Steve Ballmer and his brain trust will try their absolute best to ensure that it continues to make for one of the NBA's toughest environments for road opponents in the years to come.
A love letter to James Harden. We get the same speech from you guys year after year. Oh, man, James is tired. He was carrying a load all year. He just didn't have his leg. He not getting the same calls that he normally get. You know what remains? It's a big game. 6 or 7. Must win. At home. On the road. Playing with a superstar. Not playing with a superstar. Playing in the East. Playing in the West. Playing on the Rock. Playing on OKC in the final. Playing with the Brooklyn Nets. Playing with the Sixers. Now with the Clippers. When the postseason comes and the big games come, the James Harden that we get in the regular season is not the James Harden that we get in the postseason. You can come up with all of these facts, similes, metaphors, situations, scenarios. Hey, guaranteed like death and taxes, James Harden and his postseason performance. He still will be a first ballot Hall of Fame. He's still one of the greatest guards this game's ever seen. But when we start talking about the elite and the elite of guys in that top 75, it's just a few tables James can't sit at. And that's cool. Now on to the Clippers. Same situation as previous teams mentioned so far. Kawhi and James Harden, they're not getting to the finals in the Western Conference anymore. So what are the steps you're going to take to get there? I would like to see this team start to build in the way that they did prior to Kawhi and Paul George getting there. Some good mid-round first picks, some undervalued veterans. Really start building that depth up. Start building towards the future. Like you said, they opened up the Intuit Dome in a nice way for Steve Ballmer. Pretty respectable. But like I told you when the postseason started, and a few weeks before that, LA Clip first round exit. And that's what we got. Now to a team I was wrong about, the Indiana Pacers. I want to apologize, not to Tyrese Halliburton, because I'm not going to call you overrated, but I still don't get down with the front running steeds from dude. I'm still never going to get over wearing that hoodie after the Knicks game. No, you wear it into the game. I thought you guys were the same Pacers, man. I thought the way you guys played towards the end of the regular season with more defense, bringing the ball, moving back, pushing the pace. Yeah, I thought all of that wasn't going to sustain itself in the postseason, especially against Giannis. But I was wrong. I can't be right about everything, but I can be wrong about a few things. So to the Indiana Pacers, I apologize.
I'll say this when it comes to the Pacers. I think the biggest difference has been the improved play on the defensive end as a collective from them. That's what was missing a year ago. Offensively, I always felt like with a healthy Tyrese Halliburton, if the pieces alongside of him played up to the level that they're capable of alongside him, they could be fine. I think Tyrese Halliburton has learned when and where to pick his spots better. I've never seen him as a guy that's just going to go out and score 25 every single night. But just being that pace setter like he has been can work as long as the pieces around him are doing their respective job. I've always looked at Tyrese Halliburton as a conductor. As far as James Harden not being able to sit at the championship table, yeah, that's something that he is going to have to deal with. And he won't be the first star. He won't be the last one to go through that.
We just went past him to a whole nother team, and you brought it back up again. So everything you said about how I'm not making excuses for James, that just went completely out the window because you just revealed yourself. You couldn't even let me make that statement without you having a rebuttal for it. He cool. He one of the richest basketball players of all time. He put Adidas on his back after Derrick Rose could no longer do it. He put the Rockets on the map. Like, bro. He's never missed a postseason. He got MVP, scoring titles, assist title. You ain't got to defend this man like that. It's over with, bro. He cool. He got it, man.
Let's move on
to the guys that's still playing basketball.
All right. Let's move away from the conversation surrounding the opening tip-off to discuss the first conference semifinal matchup to get underway in the Eastern Conference. And that's the showdown between a pair of Central Division foes featuring the number 4-seeded Indiana Pacers going up against the number 1-seeded Cleveland Cavaliers. We're in the series opener. The fans on hand out in the land will see the Pacers throw the first blow and snatch home court advantage out the hands of the Cavaliers as Indiana outscored Cleveland by 7 points in the final frame to earn a 121-112 win in a back-and-forth battle and go 1-0 in the best-of-seven affair. Pacers knocked down a total of 19 triples on the night in game one, marking the second most ever in a playoff game in franchise history. Tyrese Halliburton led the way for Indiana as he finished the evening with a double-double, scoring 22 points and dishing out 13 assists to go beside 3 blocks and a steal on the other end as the Pacers shot 58% on passes from the All-Star guard, while Halliburton's backcourt partner, Andrew Nembhard, will pour in a team high of 23 points on 7-for-10 shooting to go beside 6 dimes. Cleveland, who was without the services of Darius Garland for the third straight playoff game due to a sprained left toe, was led by his all-star cast mate Donovan Mitchell, who posted 33 points, in addition to Evan Mobley's 20-point, 10-rebound night. However, it would not be enough. We know game two of this series is getting set to take place in Cleveland as we're recording this, and we'll have gone final by the time this episode drops, and that fans can catch games 3 and 4 of this series once the scene shifts to Indianapolis on ESPN and TNT respectively this coming weekend, as you can check your local listings for the times of those games. But based upon what we saw transpiring in game 1, what do you think must happen in order for the Cavs to not only draw even in this series, but regain the home court advantage?
Once again, like many things, a lot of things have synergy across the board. And these game 1 was a lot of the same common mistake. Cleveland Cavaliers, we got to get better shot selection. When them threes not going down, what are the secondary options? And with the Cleveland Cavaliers, when you speak about a secondary option, it needs to be behaving more like a primary option, and that's Evan Mobley. He got to come out the gates a lot more aggressive. He has to come out a lot more aggressive. I'm sorry. I think Evan Mobley should look at Pascal Siakam and see an aging all-star and dominate. It's like Mortal Kombat. You at the Pascal Siakam level, you feel like you the elite of the elite, go dominate him. You remember back in the day how Amari Stoudemire used to do Tim Duncan?
Yeah.
Like, nah, he wasn't. He didn't, you know, grow to be on Tim Duncan level. But when Tim Duncan saw Amari on the court, hey, for them 48 minutes, it was an equal out there. And anybody below Tim Duncan, Amari Stoudemire was dominating. He ain't show no mercy. Evan Mobley got to be the same way, man. Siakam and Miles Turner shouldn't be causing you that many problems. And like I said, Donovan Mitchell, 1-for-11 from 3, you got to do a better job at attacking. Because attacking is going to create easier shots for the other guys on the court, especially when Darius Garland isn't there to do that job.
Yeah, when I look at this series from the Cavaliers side of things, I think Darius Garland has to come back. Darius Garland is a guy that can help them to exploit mismatch, and he's going to be very important in this series. Cleveland could afford to get away with being less than 100% in their opening round series against the Miami Heat. And like Torrence alluded to, they could also get away with a poor shot selection in certain cases because those shots were falling. However, when those shots aren't falling, you tend to run into a lot of problems. And it was evident from the opening quarter, I would say, on Sunday night that the Pacers are a level up in competition. You know, they consistently generated a ton of open shots and they were hitting. And the Cavs, like I said, they're going to need Darius Garland to provide some help to Donovan Mitchell, who, in spite of finishing with 33, like you said, Torrence, he was 1-for-11 shooting-wise from downtown. And he took 30 shots. And I don't think he really started to attack the hole like he's capable of into the third quarter. And when he did, you notice the game started to change a little bit. There's a little too little too late. And they got to figure out a way to be more physical on the defensive end. I think there were too many times where Indiana was getting a lot of open looks and they weren't providing any resistance whatsoever on contest with those guys. And that's why you've seen them knock down so many shots. And then you talk about Evan Mobley. In his performance, I thought he was all right, but it's another level that he could take his game to for sure.
Yeah, but when you speak about them being more physical, that's Evan Mobley's job. You the starting power forward. Use the word power and do something with it. You see guys like Draymond Green, right or wrong, Draymond go out there and set that tone physically. You seen that with Dennis Rodman. You seen that with Ben and Rasheed Wallace, KG. You got to go set the tone physically. That 5 feet in front of the rim where all the rebounds happen at, that's where the games are won. That's where the championships won at. The team that can control and protect the glass. And a part of that is being physical below the rim. Can't let guys push you around, man.
No, I agree. And I think Jared Allen was getting hunted down in a lot of screening roles, and that's really who Halliburton and Andrew Nembhard were seeking to attack. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see Evan Mobley play more at a five a little bit more in closing time down the stretch, where he's going to have to hold his own on those one-on-one matchups, and he's going to have to take those matchups from Jared Allen and be like, look, I am the reigning defensive player of the year. If they want to headhunt the big, have them hunt me. I'm not saying that you necessarily got to hide Jared Allen, but if he doesn't find a way to be better in those matchups, you're going to have to live with Evan Mobley doing it. And I agree, like, they got to be physical, and it does start with the big, but it also starts as a collective as well, in my opinion. We discussed what the Cavs can do, though, to get back control of the series. Let's talk about the squad that has them going back to the drawing board, the Indiana Pacers. It's each member of their starting five finished the night in double figures in the series opener. We shared the big numbers from the performances of Halliburton and Nembhard a moment ago and did not even mention Aaron Nesmith's grand night as the fifth-year wing out of Vanderbilt chipped in with 17 points on 5-for-8 shooting from the floor to go beside 8 rebounds, all the while providing stellar defense that he's made his earnest living on in the contest beside a double-double from the big man and Miles Turner, which was his first double-double in the playoffs. Indiana shot better than 50% from three-point land for just the fourth time in their last 88 games during game one, marking just the second time this season that a team made at least 10 more three-pointers than Cleveland in an outing. We know teams can't always count on shots from downtown to fall at that clip consistently, no matter how spectacular your shooters might be. The ball movement, combined with their ability to control the pace, has been superb throughout these playoffs, but it's only one game. What do you think the Pacers must continue to do to not only keep the momentum in their favor, but also improve upon to place themselves one step closer towards getting back to the Eastern Conference final for what would be the second year in a row?
I mean, I already did enough apologizing, so I'm going to keep it simple. Just keep doing what you're doing. You got 2 point guards out there. You're doing a great job of managing those minutes, pushing the pace when need be in transition, playing solid defense, and to repeat myself, controlling the pace of the game. They've been doing a great job of that in the Milwaukee series, and they brought it in game one. There isn't much to change. You played a near perfect game for majority of that game one, on the road at that. So you already took one away from them. If you can take game two, that'd be awesome. If you keep doing what you're doing, I mean, this series has to go at least 6 to 7 games at this point now, just seeing that you took the first one. And the Cavs can be beat, even though they were a sneaky title contender to me all year because of the way they've played on both ends of the floor. They're starting to show, even just in game one of the reasons you can't trust them. Injuries, shot selection, guys not being physical.
Yeah, injuries are starting to pile up for Cleveland. You got the status of Darius Garland going into game two being unknown right now due to his toe injury. You got DeAndre Hunter, who dislocated his right thumb in the fourth quarter of game one, listed as probable. And then you also have Evan Mobley, who rolled his ankle in the final frame of game one, listed as prop as well. So if those three guys not able to go, that's a major problem. But I would expect at least 2 out of 3, if not all 3, to be on that floor in a situation where Cleveland cannot afford to go down 2-0, with games 3 and 4 being in Indianapolis. I think for the Pacers, though, outside of the 17 turnovers, not too much to clean up. Improve on the glass. They got out rebounding a little bit. But outside of that, I think setting the tone offensively has served as a great benefit to their defense. When you're pushing the pace at the level that Indiana is, it's oftentimes very tough to be physical with teams like that, especially when they converting the majority they look and the shots are falling. Because what that leads to happening is when the ball goes down the net, teams got to go out of bounds, get the ball in. So, like, it slows a lot down. I think if Andrew Nembhard, Aaron Nesmith could continue to shoot at the clip that they have, or that they did at least in game one, that's going to prove to pay significant dividends. I just like the way that their collective has been playing, though. And Tyrese Halliburton is definitely playing at a solid level right now, enough to where you got to respect what he's doing, no matter what feel about him as a player. And I know he could be a front runner, but right now he's playing some great basketball. And defensively, might I add as well, as you saw him get some key stops late in that game that proved to be a big part in the result.
Look, I don't have to appreciate, respect, or understand anybody that I've already decided that I have sports hate for. All right, that's a part of having sports hate for somebody is being irrational about the whole thing. That guy doesn't know me. I don't know him, right? We're going to start there with that simple fact. I know that he's a above average basketball player. I get that. I understand that he has some accolades under his belt, but I don't like him. And that's okay. That's okay. I got that right.
Okay. Now, we've told you about the things you need to have your eyes on in the series between the Pacers and Cavaliers. Well, let's get into the other Eastern Conference semifinals matchup that is going down involving two Atlantic Division squads separated by only 214.3 miles on I-90 East. And that's between the number 3-seeded New York Knicks and the number 2-seeded Boston Celtics. The defending champion Celtics were up by as many as 20 points during the third quarter and appeared to have all of the momentum in their favor at the onset of game one. But in a game where Boston launched a playoff record 63-point attempts, they'd only see a total of 15 fall through the net, all the while seeing their lead wither away as Jalen Brunson, Karl Anthony Towns, and Josh Hart would navigate through foul trouble and help the Knicks rally back as OG Anunoby and Brunson would combine to score 58 points beside double-double outings from the law firm Mahart & Towns to guide New York to a thrilling overtime win to silence Celtic faithful at the TD Garden and draw first blood in the series. In addition to this, we also saw Boston big man Kristaps Porzingis exit early out of game one after 13 minutes of action as the unicorn headed into the tunnel unexpectedly during the second quarter and did not return due to a non-COVID illness, according to Celtics personnel, while Al Horford started in Porzingis' place during the second half. Now, I do think, even in spite of all that transpired in game one, Torrance, many would still consider the Celtics as the overwhelming favorite in this series, as all of the fans listening to a stateside can check out game two, going down out in Beantown on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central on TNT, prior to making its way to New York City for game three at MSG on Saturday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Central Time over on ABC. But I got to ask you, though, what do you make of the C's collapse in game one after managing to make light work of the Knicks throughout the regular season?
You call Hart and Towns a law firm. I'm going to tell you one thing. Karl Anthony Towns, definitely not a defense lawyer. I'm going to get that out the way and establish. That was crazy, man. You journalists and media guys, boy, you got away with work. This Boston Celtics collapse isn't a Boston Celtics collapse. It's a Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum collapse. You are the guys with the experience on the team. You've been to countless Eastern Conference finals. You've been in the playoffs every year of you guys' career. They both ended with 23 points, 5 from 25 from 3, 14 of 43 from the field. Jason Tatum kept shooting step-back threes over Jalen Brunson.
I know.
Jaylen Brown was just shooting anything because he tends to do that. He just gets the ball and decides he's not even passing the ball anymore, which I understand, I guess. You know, the other guy's struggling, but guess what? You're struggling too. You don't have to stay rigid with this three-point approach. You know, I've been pointing this out all season. Hey, Boston trying to shoot 53s a game. Well, midway through the fourth quarter, they were 13 of 53 from the three-point line. And I'm looking like, at what point are you guys going to stop and just attack the rim? You got Cat in foul trouble early in the game. He had three fouls. A large part as to how you built the lead over the Knicks. You get to the second half, and you stop attacking him and Brunson, who also had three fouls? Yeah, it's not a Celtics collapse. I'm not blaming Joe Mazzulla. I'm not blaming Peyton Pritchard. Al Horford gave a great effort. Luke Kornet, before he got in the foul trouble, he was providing some great paint work. Porzingis gave them absolutely nothing. They tried to force the ball to him early in the first quarter. He said he's sick. I don't know. I'm not in that man's circle. I just know that he had a terrible game. All that other stuff he could have kept to himself. Derrick White. I love the game Derrick White played, but I also don't like the fact that he shot 16 threes. We just got to get some better basketball, man. You got to get some better basketball. You got to have secondary options in sports.
Yeah, it starts with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown for sure.
That's and ends with them.
Definitely. Yeah, it starts and there and it ends. No, I agree because they had mismatches time and time again. And you talk about Tatum getting the matchup with Brunson. Oh, man. Just watching that live time. Performances such as though is why a lot of fans feel like they have the audacity to talk a lot of shit about him. And Jason Tatum has had performances thus far in these playoffs, specifically in the Orlando series, that made you say, that's the Jason Tatum that you want to see. You know, that's the Jason Tatum that you want and recognize is the face of the league. And when you see him performing like that and not taking advantage of mismatch time, and time again, it's a problem. It's a major problem, and him and Jaylen Brown got to be better. You can't play around with a lead like that in a playoff set. Once you see that lead go from 20 to at least 15 to 10, you got to be like, hey, if these shots not falling, let's seek to attack the paint. It's definitely on them. And Derrick White taking 16 threes, yeah, that's definitely not something that you want to see. Kristaps Porzingis, I'm not going to lie, I'm very concerned about him. I knew something wasn't right from the get-go of that game because he wasn't moving right. I thought it might have been injury-related, but to find out that it's an illness, especially a non-COVID-related illness, when he happened to miss an extensive bit of time late in the season due to an illness that was also non-COVID related, but the team specified as a non-respiratory illness. I really hope he's all right. They missed him late down the stretch as well, because in situations such as those, having a guy like him when he's healthy and upright proves to work wonders for them. So what I make of it is, it's just one game, but games like that is what oftentimes makes it tough for people to trust the Celtics, even in spite of them possessing the championship pedigree that they have.
Yeah, Porzingis, he's the mid-range jump shooter usually in that system when they can put him at the free throw line on a mismatch. But you got to adjust. Jason Tatum, 6'10".
And he got a mid-range game with the ability to post guys up. And Jaylen Brown has the ability to take advantage of smaller guards as well. That's the thing that I think fans are going to have to watch out for in game two. What does their shot diet look like? Will Kristaps Porzingis be back for game two? But want to ask you, New York, we saw them come from behind. Wins like these typically give squads confidence. With the Knicks having beat the Celtics after having gone winless against Boston during the regular season, how much do you think this could do for them moving forward in the series? Do you still see this being a series where the Celtics take care of business in five? Or do you see it being a series that gets extended?
This series was always a possible six-game series just because of the Atlantic Division. I won't even call it rivalry, but just familiarity between the two teams. We also know that the Knicks kind of built themselves to compete directly with the Boston Celtics, going to go get Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby to have on the wing for Brown and Tatum. I just want to really shout those two guys out, too. It was OG's effort in the third quarter, and it was Mikal in overtime as to how the Knicks got this game. But as far as confidence, nah, man. Confidence has nothing to do with it. This team has a lot of very confident guys. Jalen Brunson's an undersized guard who won clutch player of the year. You know, Karl Anthony Towns, he's adapted to the Knicks and New York City a lot better than most people had thought. Josh Hart is an undersized power forward. The reason they might not survive this series past five games is because Thibodeau is still struggling to find guys rest. It was the 8-16 mark in the fourth quarter. Brunson had just subbed back in. Reggie Miller, he was calling for Thibodeau to like, hey man, this will be a perfect time to get Josh Hart just a few minutes to rest. He out there guarding on the perimeter, getting offensive and defensive rebounds. It's like, fam, I know you're trying to win this game, but damn, think of the long term. And the long term is just a seven-game series. Deuce McBride was playing pretty well. Mitchell Robinson was playing pretty well. And I believe at that time, Mikal Bridges was on the bench. So come on, man. You gotta get them guys a shot. But no, I still got the Celtics in five or six games.
I do as well.
Because here's the thing: 15-60 for shooting threes, right? They only lost by 3 points. The Knicks shot 45% from three. The Knicks played pretty much statistically about what they play on a given night. So they were who they were. The Celtics had their bad game already. I expect them to take care of business from here on out.
Yeah, because it's hard to shoot 25% from three back-to-back games. It's good that they did get it out their system early, but to blow a 20-point lead the way that they did, you never want to see that. But I wouldn't panic if I was a Celtics fan at all off of that game. However, it's games like that that I do believe why people have a problem with the way in which they play, something that we know quite well because, like you said, and when we talked about this team earlier in the year on the new 24, we talked about how this team is going to play five out and seek to get up 50-plus threes a night. And they're going to live by it as much as they die by it sometimes. They just so happen to live by it most of the time and come out on top three out of four times per game. carrying things along from the discussion surrounding the two series going down on the Eastern Conference side of the playoff bracket, to discuss the first semifinal bout to tip off in the Western Conference side of things is we got the number four seeded Denver Nuggets going against the number one seeded Oklahoma City Thunder, where in game one, we saw the Nuggets storm their way back from a 14-point deficit in the second half and snatch the series opener away from an Oklahoma City squad despite being at a six-day rest disadvantage, as the three-time MVP in Nikola Jokic showed why he's arguably the most dominant force in the game once again, exploding for 42 points along the way to hauling down 22 boards and dishing out six dimes to keep Denver in the outing, while the Thunder's offense will falter late as a pair of missed free throws from Chet Holmgren, where OKC up by one would lead to the door being left open for Nuggets forward Aaron Gordon to go about playing the role of spoiler for fans in the Sooner State by hitting a clutch triple on the wing that proved to be the game-winning shot and guide his team to a 1-0 lead in the series, as you can catch game two of this series on Wednesday night, shortly following that Knicks-Celtics showdown over on TNT. Denver shot just 29% from downtown against OKC in game one, all the while committing a total of 18 turnovers in the series opener, following a hard-fought series with the LA Clippers in round one. However, they still emerged from the battle victoriously, even in spite of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Alex Caruso managing to combine for 53 of the Thunder's 119 points on the night, as their entire starting five would finish the game in double figures. But we witnessed Oklahoma City head coach Mark Dagnall decide to foul with his team up by three with less than 10.1 seconds to go, despite Jokic being out the game due to having five fouls and the Nuggets not wanting to risk him picking up his sixth on an intentional foul to preserve the clock on a previous play in which SGA roamed free on an inbound pass for a dunk. Thunder boasted not only the best defense in the league during the regular season, but the best three-point defense in the league, allowing opponents to make just 34.2% of their looks from beyond the arc. It's a strategy they've used all year long, and we know you can't put it all on the coach, as you got to make your free throws this time of year. However, what do you personally make of Dagnall's strategy for Oklahoma City late in game one?
I mean, I don't make too much of it. Like, I've said it before, I'll say it again. OKC, their future is going to live and die with the development and the production of Chet Holmgren. He's the guy that missed those free throws. He's the guy that, one of the guys that allowed 22 rebounds. He's the guy that got out-muscled in the paint. It was even a play in transition where him and Jokic were tussling back and forth. Chet almost ended up in the front row, you know, so him and J-Dub, they got to play better. It's just as simple as that. Y'all get this team a lot of praise, a lot of love, and nobody's thinking about the coach when they say that. You know, I get the whole, we want to look at the strategy, this, that, and the third. Nah, man. They were in control of this game. They lost the lead. Things happen. Those two guys got to play better.
When I assess the strategy of Mark Dagnall late in game one, I understand where he was coming from. He's looking at it from the analytical angle. While I understand that, and I don't put all of this on Mark Dagnall whatsoever, because guys do have to make plays, especially when the game is not only there for the taking, but it's a game that they've controlled for the majority of the contest, which Oklahoma City did in game one. However, sometimes you got to play the percentages. And if you up three, you got to trust your player. You got Lou Dort out there, one of the best wing defenders in the NBA. You got one of the best defense in the NBA. And you know that this is a team that's coming in 48 hours removed from a hard-fought series with the Clippers in the opening round. And if they were struggling to shoot three all night long, play the percentage and trust your guy. That's just my theory. Now, I understand that they've been doing it all year, but sometimes you have to also recognize the feel for the game and take some chances here and there. And I felt like that was a situation where they could afford to take a chance and trust their defense. Unfortunately, the plan didn't work out, but I don't think that that was Dagnall's fault. I just feel like he could have approached it a little bit different. But as I said, this isn't no shot at Mark Dagnall as a coach whatsoever. Guys do have to execute. You win as a team and you lose as a team.
We don't even know who Mark Dagnall is, for real. He ain't Eric Spoelstra. He ain't Steve Kerr. He ain't Doc Rivers. He ain't even Rick Carlisle. He's a nameless, faceless coach. Chet Holmgren has to be better. He has to be better. You gotta let the MVP, help the MVP look good. SGA came with his production. Yeah, statistically, Technically, he got outplayed by Nikola Jokic, but he did his part. Where's the backup? Where's the support?
No, I get what you're saying. Caruso had a great game as well. He was shooting the lights out from three-point land off the bench. Very impressive performance.
That's the GOAT right there. We know what he do when it's big game time. We never worried about that guy right there, man. Former Chicago Bull, always going to have love for Caruso. Chad Holmgren, Jalen Williams. Show us something, man.
Yeah, shout out to Elmer Fudd, man. But you know, we talked about
who? Hold on,
Elmer Fudd.
Who is that?
Caruso. All
right, man. Let's stop with the silly shit, man.
You know, we talked about Mark Dagnall's strategy in game one not working out in the manner he hoped for. But I don't want to let that singular moment take away from this matchup between a pair of squads who split their regular season series. You got a matchup between the two leading candidates in this year's race for MVP and Nikola Jokic and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Not to mention the NBA's premier defense going up against one of the top offensive attacks who just two seasons ago captured the championship. What are some of the things that you think the fans listening to us here on the New 24 should have their eyes on when watching this particular series?
How well Chet Holmgren and Jalen Williams play. I'm telling you, man, I'm going to stay on this point. SGA and Jokic are kind of a wash, right? The next two best players on the Denver Nuggets are supposed to be Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. Aaron Gordon has throughout this postseason proven to be the second guy for real, but that's just a guy that's a star in his role. Chet and J-Dub should be able to outplay Murray and Porter. That should at least be their goal. You can't give Nikola Jokic any breathing room. You can't let him be within striking distance of winning a game because he starts to come down like a Peyton Manning or a Tom Brady and he starts executing in that half court and they become unstoppable. He's leaving with points every time down the court. And SGA, he can't create every shot for you guys. That's what J-Dub is supposed to be. You're supposed to be the second shot creator. Chet, you're the stretch big who can score on the inside and outside and run the floor and be rim protection. So that's what guys got to look out for. I know a lot of people haven't seen OKC. I know y'all love them for whatever reasons y'all love them. You actually watch this team, those are the guys to watch.
I understand why you're saying it, because when SGA goes to the bench, J-Dub is the one running the offense, and that's typically where they tend to struggle at. And we know what SGA can bring to the table. And Chet Holmgren, I know, is a guy that you've been adamant in saying that he's the most important piece in determining not only how far Oklahoma City goes in the playoffs, but whether or not they could capture an NBA championship. So I understand that. As far as what I'm looking forward to watching in this series is how does Denver's zone defense go about impacting Oklahoma City's offense? That was something that they utilized to success in the previous round against the Los Angeles Clippers. And I know that they're not going to go away from that. A lot of teams in these playoffs been playing zone. The Nuggets are no different. I just want to see whether or not that works. And I want to see also, how can Oklahoma City respond from this loss? Because for the first time in these 2025 playoffs, they're being tested. There was some part of that opening round series against the Memphis Grizzlies where you could say the Thunder didn't play their best basketball, but they were able to get away with their sin. Some things you're not going to be able to get away with in this series against them. We're going to find out what that is very soon.
And I mean, got to give a shout out to Russell Westbrook for the job he did in game one, coming up big. Something that, you know, if he did the other thing, be the reason as to why they lost, he would be getting his fair share of criticism. So, you know, just want to give, you know, give Russ some love.
No, absolutely. He deserves all of that. And if it wasn't for him in the opening round against the Los Angeles Clippers, I don't believe that the Denver Nuggets are at this point in position in the Western Conference semifinals for the third consecutive year. I know plenty of people who have been very quick to criticize him for his lackluster outing or ineptitude in critical junctures of games, most notably prior to the conclusion of regular season when they lost at home against the Minnesota Timberwolves. He's knocking down corner three-point shots at the level of a PJ Tucker, you know, a few years ago. Like, anytime you shooting over 40%+ from long range, you got to tip your cap to him. And teams are daring him to shoot it. And when I say he's shooting it like PJ Tucker, trust me, I know Russell Westbrook is a far superior player. But it's cool to see players who were once considered he's with us guys stepping up when the opportunity presents itself, albeit in a reserve role, a role that Russell Westbrook, I think, has embraced mightily well and seems to have found a great landing spot in Denver. And kudos to Aaron Gordon also, a guy that a lot of people, when he was in Orlando, wondered whether or not he could contribute to a winning environment. Well, he's showing that he can. And when he's playing at a high level, he looks like the best number three option in the NBA outside of Kristaps Porzingis.
I don't even consider him a really option. He's just a guy that's smart, man. He got traded over there, immediately started to befriend Jokic, even went over to Jokic's country in the offseason. Because he's a smart man. You playing with a future Hall of Famer MVP, man. You got to secure that spot. And when you secure that spot, you got to maximize your role and be a star in it. And that's what he's done. That's what he's done.
And what I appreciate the most about Aaron Gordon, he does the dirty work too. You know, it's not easy for a lot of guys to do that, especially when you consider the career that he's had prior to reaching the NBA. This was a guy that was an All-American, you know, at Arizona in high school, lottery pick. To be that ultimate glue guy, everybody can make that transition. So kudos to AG for being able to do that, especially everything that he's navigated through over the last year, personally losing his brother and whatnot. So salute to him. And last but not least, we have another scintillating best of seven series in the Western Conference that pits a veteran squad up against a young core that managed to make a valiant run to the conference finals a year ago, who was in search for a better finish this go-round, and that's the highly anticipated meeting between the number seven-seeded Golden State Warriors and number six-seeded Minnesota Timberwolves, a clash that features a pair of teams that had to earn their way into the playoffs during the final days of the regular season, as we watch the Dubs make it past the play-in tourney before defeating the Rockets in the opening round in seven games to advance to this stage, while the Timberwolves would go on a late-season surge to narrowly avoid the play-in round to snatch the sixth seed before dispatching the Los Angeles Lakers in five games in round one of these playoffs to make it back to the Western Conference semifinal round for the second consecutive season in a row. This is a playoff matchup that has a ton of layers to it, from Minnesota passing up on Stephen Curry not once but twice all the way back in the 2009 NBA draft, to the trade that nearly went down between these two squads long before Golden State ever considered themselves light years ahead of the NBA. As those who follow the game, I'm sure, can recall the time where Klay Thompson was almost shipped off to the Twin Cities in exchange for Kevin Love. Not to mention the beef between Draymond Green and Rudy Gobert, and the fact that the Warriors could have moved up to take Anthony Edwards, number one overall, in the 2020 NBA draft, but decided not to, even though the Timberwolves were reportedly open to trading that pick at the time. Hell, Dante DiVincenzo was once a member of the Warriors just a couple years back. Now, game one of this series will have gone final by the time this episode releases, as you can catch game two at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 p.m. Central, this Thursday night on TNT, prior to the series sliding out to the Bay Area for games three and four. But when it comes to this matchup, Torrance, what specific items will you have your eyes on?
A 5-on-5 game on the court. That's what I'm going to have my eye on. I'm not breaking this down into bits and pieces. This is a good matchup. We got Ant against Steph Curry. Can't Ant get it done? You got KD out the way. You got Bron out the way. Can you collect the last Infinity Stone so we can completely move on to a new era? That's what we need you to do, man. Because I was ready to come in here and talk crazy about the Warriors, but the Rockets let me down. But you know what? Steph Curry has their number. 5-0 in the postseason against the Houston Rockets. That was forgave everybody.
I know.
Has Rudy Gobert learned his lesson? I've been telling you all week, this is Rudy's revenge. That's what this series should be called. If it was a movie, this is Rudy's revenge. Hey, I want Rudy to go out there and set the tone. You remember how Kobe knocked Pau Gasol down in the Olympics? Yeah, I need somebody to do that to Draymond one of these rounds. Go ahead and let Draymond know it's going to be a long series. Julius Randle, Naz Reid, somebody got to do it. But in all seriousness, though, man, nah, I'm just really looking forward to seeing if the Minnesota Timberwolves can take that next step, as you saw LeBron tell Anthony Edwards, trying to take that next step. This is the one. This is the one. You've improved as a three-point shooter. You've improved as a playmaker. Your feel for the game. We know you can lock in on defense. Chris Finch, are you going to make the necessary moves that need to be made when Steph Curry starts to go off from the three-point line because they got Rudy on the perimeter? Are you going to stick to your guns and maintain your size? That's going to be an advantage all series long against the Warriors. Are you going to seek to stop guys like Buddy Hield from going off? Because no Buddy Hield the other night, then the Houston Rockets win that series because Steph struggled a lot in the first half. And Steph has been having up and down games this postseason. And I think the Timberwolves are equipped in a lot of ways defensively the same way the Rockets were, if not better. Can Jaden McDaniels continue to be an offensive threat? I don't know. DiVincenzo and Naz Reid, they're going to have to knock down three. I'm not going to use my fandom for Steph and Bron like I did the last round. Get rid of Steph in these six games. Let's get this done. I'm done seeing them on my TV screen. Draymond done found a new technical foul loophole. If y'all been noticing, he been getting flagrant fouls every game. Every game.
And he get them early, like you say.
I keep telling y'all to just watch, man. He gets that flagrant or he gets that tech early in the game and he puts the pressure on the refs. Are you going to really eject Draymond Green from this playoff game? I'm throwing him out. I don't care. You're not going to keep playing with me like that. I'm throwing him out. I'm throwing him out. Yeah, I'm done. So forget the objective view. I need the Warriors to get eliminated.
Interesting how Anthony Edwards' postseason art is something unlike any other. Because if this man happens to take down Stephen Curry, he will have taken down Bron, KD, Jokic. That's four Hall of Famers. And you would think if I told you that without any context added to it, you would think that he already has a ring on his trophy case. You really would.
No, you wouldn't.
You really would.
We all have been watching his career. We know he's young. We just...
We
never seen somebody handle business like this. Because, see, when Michael Jordan played Larry Bird, he got swept, you know, as an AFC. Magic Johnson, his rookie year, he just ran through it. Even Bron, like, yeah, his postseason career started off with the Washington Wizards. We never really seen nobody start at the top of the mountain.
That's my point. And I'm saying, if I was to tell somebody
that, don't
that
mean
is
no
not
ring.
Aware of basketball, that he beat these figures, they probably would assume that he's won a championship.
Man.
But anyway, I get back
you
to
know,
the
you
series.
You know who don't have a championship ring?
Yes, I do. I do know. You don't have to revive. But anyway, right. I want to know, can Julius Randle continue to keep up at the level that he has produced thus far in these playoffs? Past couple years, he was either too injured to play or he struggled immensely when he did as a member of the New York Knicks. Averaged 23 points on 48% shooting from the floor, put together some great stretches of defense against the Lakers, hit some timely shots in that opening round series as well, as they made quick work of them in five games. I know one round isn't impressive enough to turn the narrative around for him. However, if he wants to satisfy not only himself, but silence the criticism and the noise around him, carrying his performance in the opening round into this series could be what helps him to earn a rich contract extension and to fortify a home for himself out in the Twin Cities this summer. Can he do it? I'm curious to find out. You talk about Jaden McDaniels was solid as an off-ball player and as well as a cutter offense. We saw the job that he did defensively against Luka Doncic. I'm pretty sure he's going to be the one that gets the primary assignment on to Stephen Curry. And he continued to hold his own. Anthony Edwards, I'm not worried about one bit at all, because when I watch him, he's the most confident player in the league. And I truly believe after knocking off LeBron James and receiving the message that he got from him in Los Angeles following game five, that he understands what time it is. And I feel like it's only going to take his game to another level. Because as you know, Torrence, and you said last week, when you beat LeBron James in a best of seven series, I don't give a damn if it's year seven LeBron or year 22 LeBron. It means something. It means a lot. And I'm pretty sure that LeBron has some moments in the previous round that made him say when he watched Ant, "You remind me of someone." And I think we know who that someone was. That was a younger version of LeBron. I want to see Minnesota, the team that I've dubbed as America's team over the last couple postseasons, live up to it. And I believe that they will. If I have to make a prediction right now, I would say Minnesota could win this series in five games. I truly believe that.
Look, man, I remember when the Dallas Mavericks beat the Heat in the finals and Mo Williams said, "Thank you, Dallas, for healing my heart." Minnesota, Timberwolves, Anthony Edwards, please, please, I'm begging you, get those Warriors out of this postseason. We need it. We need it.
And on the Warriors side, I want to see how long Steve Kerr is going to hold Jonathan Kuminga in the doghouse. No, the reason why I want to see it, just hear me out.
I don't want to hear you out. We're not talking about Kuminga.
You're going to hear me
out. You know what?
Because this is a basketball-related thing.
I got
this
somebody
ain't no
better.
Bullshit.
Nah, but I got somebody better than Kuminga. Kevon Looney. The Timberwolves, don't let him be a problem. Every round, Kevon Looney just happens to be a problem. Can't nobody keep that man off the boards. He just makes the right play. Guys like Gary Payton II. Yeah, let's talk about the guys that actually play. I don't care about that Steve Kerr, Jonathan Kuminga saga that they got going on over there.
I see you really haunted by Golden State. Now I understand. But
I'm
the
not
reason
haunted.
why, but the
You
reason
haunted
why,
by
but
them.
the reason why.
They kept your boy from winning stuff.
Hey.
That's who haunted. I ain't worried about them. I know what it's like for them to lose. I just want the truth to be revealed. They ain't who y'all think they is.
What I want to know, what I would like to know, is Steve Kerr going to play Kuminga? Because you know why? The Warriors lack a lot of length and athleticism. The Wolves had plenty of it.
He
can't
gonna play
have to play him at
basketball.
Some point.
He can't play basketball, okay? Steve Kerr doesn't believe that Jonathan Kuminga could play high IQ basketball, all right? That's what everybody needs to hear. Is that what it is? He think the boy basketball dumb, y'all. He think the boy stoop when it comes to the round ball.
And I understand that, but every coach is tested in certain series, as you know. Desperate times call for desperate measures. I'm not saying that Kuminga's an X factor. I just want
yes, you
to
are.
Know.
Yes,
no,
you
I'm
are.
Not.
Well, so why are you talking about him?
Because it's something that intrigues me.
Something to talk
about. Is that
about.
A problem?
Yeah, it is actually a problem. And shout out to Draymond Green, too, man, for always coming up big in these game sevens, man. For real. Even if it's not on the stat sheet. I talk crap, but he came out and set that tone in that first half, man. Let the Rockets know that they were going to have to, like, take it from him to win that game that night. And they didn't. Bullies need to get bullied, man.
Oh, his time is coming in this series. I expect for him and Rudy Gobert to have
Rudy's
word.
Rudy's revenge, man. This is Rudy's revenge.
It's coming. They will definitely
put that
have
brother
to be separated a few times in this series.
Nah, don't no. Look, like Rudy, take the suspension. Somebody got to take the suspension, man.
It can't be Rudy. It got to be somebody that's willing to come off the sideline.
Nah, listen. I get that he the basketball. You know, missing him basketball for that game or two. I heard, but you know what? That team in that city might be energized at a whole nother level, man. Stand on business with Draymond, man, because, you know, I ain't going to say nothing crazy, man, because I still got respect for guys as men. But stand on business. It's time, man. Rudy's revenge.
Well, that's a wrap on yet another episode of the New 24. If you've enjoyed what you've heard through the first 26 episodes, including this one, please feel free to leave us a 5-star rating with additional commentary in the comment section, letting us know just what you like about it across the platform you use to listen to your favorite shows. We can't thank you enough for all of your support. Make sure to also give us a follow on the official social media platform for the New 24 across Instagram and X at TNTF_ to make sure you don't miss any announcements as it pertains to future shows and episodes, including on all of the latest currently trending around the NBA today. Don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feed as well directly at rss.com/podcast/TNTF. Definitely continue to stay in tune with us to get everything you need as far as it pertains to the 2025 postseason. Once again, for myself, Gabriel Wilkins, and my co-host, Torrence Stagger, we appreciate you tuning in yet again and hope you enjoy the rest of your week out there. And as always,